This is the Own It Show, where we tell stories of how everyday people made ownership theirs to create extraordinary success.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Own It Show Coach Conversations, because those are where the best conversations happen. I'm Justin.
And I'm Elise. Welcome to the show.
And guys, I know we always talk about community, and what does community mean? How do we bring amongst change in this world that is ever changing? And I think somebody that has done it so well when Elise and I are looking to bring on guests is people that have been able to bring this not only into fruition and created something amazing, but experienced things and have been fully immersed in it. And our guest today has been able to do that at scale and has been able to truly impact women around the world. And so without further ado, Jennifer, thank you so much for spending time with us today and really being able to dive into your story and ultimately what you're bringing to the world.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I'd love for you to share with our audience a little bit about your background and how you kind of led into this feminist movement and this ability to really empower women in this business world.
Okay, well, my background is that when I was in college, I was majoring in philosophy. And there's a classic joke about that, by the way. The joke is, how do you get a philosophy major off your porch? And the answer is,
how?
Pay him for the pizza. So while I was majoring in philosophy, I started my first company, which was a web development company. And I had about 8 part-time employees by the time I graduated. And so I was doing that and, you know, sort of doing my philosophy classes on the side for the last couple of years of college. And, you know, so I came from this background where it just seemed very natural to me that I wouldn't want to have a boss or go through the corporate recruiting process at Dartmouth with a bunch of guys in their polar fleece. It just didn't feel like my scene. And I also just didn't know what investment banking was. There's just a lot of that up there. It was unclear on the concept. So I ran this company, which ultimately failed when I was 23. And so that was really, at the time, you know, very devastating. Like some people have their devastating breakup at the age of 23. And I had this, you know, my business was shuttered by the sheriff, you know, like I hadn't paid my rent and I wasn't allowed in the building and my office plants were dying of dehydration. I mean, it was just at the time as a young person, you know, it was extremely stressful. And
those of you who are listening on audio only, she now has 2 fully flourishing plants over her shoulder. So we know that she does know how to look after plants very well.
Thank you. thank you very much. So when my company failed, when I was 23, it, you know, had a real outsized effect on me. And in some ways, I think it was really positive in that after that, you know, I kind of broke my ability to feel stressed like a normal person. I experienced so, like when you blow out a speaker, you know, you just play your music too loud or you destroy the speaker. I just blew out my stress meter. Like I just don't feel stressed the way normal people do, I think. And that's been really helpful to me in the, you know, nearly 20 years since then. So after my company failed, I did a whole bunch of weird things for a decade. I was a stand-up comedian, a whole bunch of strange stuff. And eventually I got back into something I sort of have been doing all my life, which was a standardized test prep. And so, you know, I had been tutoring other kids for the SAT when I was in high school, you know, things like that. And so I got back into it and I worked for, you know, all the big companies. And eventually I got this sort of dream job teaching the GMAT, the best GMAT company in America. And I had actually had to study to get that job, which was new for me. And I was teaching the GMAT and able to do things like pitch a book that the company would publish. You know, I had an idea, I would pitch it, I would get to write it, I would get to edit it, the company would publish it. And I could just sort of go straight to the CEO and suggest things. That CEO, by the way, was Andrew Yang, which is just really random, like the presidential candidate, super random. But, you know, that was just seems like a detail I ought to mention. So I was doing so well at this company and just really enjoying being at kind of an agile small company where you can have ideas and run with them. Sometimes you get turned down, sometimes they get accepted and you can sort of just make things happen and negotiate. And I wanted to share some things that I had learned with other people and especially with young women. And I felt like in my own life, I had been raised to certainly not to be entrepreneurial. But also, I think that I had been raised perhaps in a way where young women often get a real pat on the head for doing very small things. And, you know, the sort of thing, there are some parents out there, I'm saying some, so many qualifications here, but there definitely are some parents where, you know, if their daughter has some kind of small plan, they would say, oh, that's really wonderful. And if their son had the exact same plan, they would say, you need to think bigger than that. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that's not a future.
Right.
You know, how are you ever going to support a family? And there's research about this. I mean, obviously not everyone is heterosexual. Not everybody wants to have kids. There's so many exceptions, but there's still research showing that even young people who are just out of college, who are not necessarily thinking at all about getting married or having kids or anything like that, young men right out of college, not a real marriageable group right there, are still, when they negotiate for their first salary, are thinking about someday supporting a family. It's just in the back of their head that that's their job. Even though, you know, so many things have changed, but some things haven't. And so young women are usually not thinking that. And if you, you know, as we all know, when you negotiate for a job, you know, your subsequent salaries tend to depend very heavily on where you started. You know, if you start off $10,000 behind some other guy, you know, six jobs down the line, you're probably still going to be making $10,000 less than that guy, you know, like the rising tide, you know, well, anyway. So I had these ideas that I wanted to share, and especially with young women. And I just happened to go to a networking event, which, gosh, I don't like those. I don't go to very many. So when I go to a physical networking event, especially where I don't really know people, I have a two-person rule. That's the number of people I will have a conversation with before I am permitted to leave. Two, the number is two. Like, you know, you think like three is the magic number, but that's too many. I don't want to do that. You know, two is my number. And, you know, so two conversations and I am out. And, you know, that's enough time to have your, you know, terrible free glass of wine. And you're just, you know, anyway, so I went to a networking event and I ended up meeting a woman who, it was a very girly experience. You know, she complimented something I was wearing. We ended up talking and turned out she was one of the new editors at a women's blog that no longer exists, but this was 2010. And she said they were hiring writers. And I said, I have some ideas. And I ended up writing a column for this blog that was primarily about beauty and fashion. And I actually contributed a couple of articles about beauty and fashion, which I have not that much to say about. You know, I was like, I have one hack for penciling your eyebrows really perfectly, you know, and I'm done. That's it. That's all I have. So that's pretty much my knowledge in that area. And so, and then I said, you know, I really just want to write about careers and business. And, but, you know, I want to do it for people who don't normally read those things, you know, for women who are reading, young women who are reading this fashion and beauty blog. And I started writing this column and it needed a name. At the time I was living on Wall Street, like one block off from Wall Street. And the Wall Street Bull is not actually on Wall Street. You know, the Wall mm-hmm. Street Bull, the famous statue that people come to visit, it's actually on Broadway. And a lot of tourists are confused. And so I would be answering questions from people, you know, just walking around outside my apartment. People would say, you know, El Toro, where's the bull? You know, asking in all kinds of languages, you know, for the bull, making hand gestures, where's the bull? And I was directing people there. And so the bull was kind of top of mind. And this was right around the time of the financial crisis, you know, 2010, like a little after. The reason I had the apartment on Wall Street is probably that, you know, like some investment banker had been booted out of it, you know, during the financial crisis. So I got a really good deal. And so, you know, I'm looking to name this column about business and careers and negotiating. And this bull was just always there. And if you actually go to the Wall Street Bull, so just if anyone's not familiar, I mean, this is a big bronze, you know, statue, larger than life-size statue of a snorting masculine, like bull. And people like to rub the testicles of the bull. That's what they like to do there. They take pictures at the back end of the bull, all the tourists, like they've rubbed them so much, they're very shiny. That's how statues work. You can tell what parts of the statue people have been touching. So it just struck me as so funny that, you know, in the wake of the financial crisis, that this snorting bull would be considered the symbol of business, like the symbol of the economy. You know, like who does business that way? You know, like how is that the symbol of any kind of success? You know, just like snorting and destroying things and charging. And, you know, that was the financial crisis. And so I named my column Bullish as sort of a joke based on that. And later developed a logo that's a bull with a unicorn horn on it. sort of a rainbow bowl with a unicorn horn on it. It's a bowl of corn. And, you know, so I certainly can see that since then, maybe the name of this business has been a little bit confusing to other people because I have to retell the story for it to make any sense. But it's been so long, I'm stuck with it now. So that's how Get Bullish came to be. I wrote these columns for about 2 years for this site that no longer exists. And so at some point, very, you know, presciently, I started moving the columns over to my own website, and everything kind of went from there.
I'm so like, I love the story because there's, you talk about all these different avenues you went into comedy and into the financial space, graduating from Dartmouth, writing, not going in networking, being at these events. And now you, who hates networking, actually built this ecosystem that allows women to empower other women and do exactly that, just network in a really empowering way.
You know, in a different way, absolutely. I mean, I think that it's not just being a woman. I mean, some women are tremendous extroverts and they love networking, but it's also, you know, being an introvert or even being a kind of an academically minded person. There are people who have fantastic intellectual skills, people who write very well, people who do all kinds of things that aren't schmoozing, people who feel uncomfortable in crowds but have many other talents that are great for networking, but not at a wine and cheese type event. And so, you know, I think I've written a number of, so many articles about this actually, but there are ways that you can network that don't involve kind of a crowd and that play to those strengths. So I've often recommended, you know, networking by like, you know, really just doing something like writing a blog or putting out a podcast. And, you know, as you well know, it can be great ways to network, but also even people who feel uncomfortable walking into a crowd where they don't know people often do very well when they're actually hosting an event and they're in charge of it. So, you know, having, for example, a themed brunch at a restaurant where you invited, you know, 10 people and you're just going to sit around and have brunch and talk about a topic that you've decided. A lot of people feel comfortable when they're sort of in charge of something, you know, they have a role, they know what's going to happen. People know who they are before they arrive. So there are lots of ways around that. I mean, it's also, you know, you can have a chilly dinner in your living room and, you know, even if you are a, you know, a young millennial and everyone's sitting on the floor eating your cheap chili, people love that stuff. People absolutely love that stuff. You know, because for everybody who wants to dress up and do the wine and cheese, or if people even do that anymore, you know, there's somebody else who just wants to wear their sweatpants and eat your chili. And those people have jobs too, and often important ones.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's, you know, it's a really amazing and different way and non-stereotypical way to make people comfortable in doing those types of things. So one of the things, Jen, I really want to go back to is something that you mentioned earlier on a couple minutes ago, was this idea of your stress speakers completely blowing up at a very young age. You had been through something that was catastrophic for you, but oftentimes when we experience that type of a life event, when we're in it, it feels like the worst thing in the world. But once we get through it, oftentimes those events become something that's probably one of our most empowering moments that allowed us to be who we are today. I'm curious to hear if you resonate with that, if you agree with that, and if so, how have you been able to take that experience to be who you are and help others today?
I certainly think that I wouldn't have done so many things I've done with my life in the last 20 years if I hadn't had that experience of, you know, now as an older person, you know, it seems a little bit ridiculous that I could, you know, my 23-year-old self was out there saying, I've lost everything. Everything I've ever worked for is gone. You know, and I really felt like, you know, I had given up my youth, you know, like all those times I could have gone to a party or had a friend, you know, like I didn't do any of those things. Like I was working the whole time to get into college and, you know, do all the, you know, start my company and so on and so forth. So to me, it's comical now to look back, you know, a 23-year-old is like everything I've worked for in my whole life, you know, it's funny now, but it wasn't at the time. And I think that I had this feeling of just, I mean, that's when I moved to New York after that. And I moved to New York with $400 and no place to live and, you know, a beat up car. My car got stolen the first week I was there. It wasn't insured. again, I was broke. So, it was just this, I did everything off Craigslist. Like I moved to New York. I found a roommate on Craigslist. After my car was stolen with all my business clothes in it, I went on Craigslist and, asked if anybody had some interview clothes that I could get from them. And, I just did everything on Craigslist. And I bartered for office space. As soon as I got to New York, I had $0. I mean, I had spent my $400, being a roommate of somebody in East Harlem. They had a little hallway for rent, one of those railroad apartments, So, none of this bothered me at all. It's like this sort of stuff that, it would be difficult to do at this age, but it really freed me. I know when you feel like you have lost a lot of things, you might as well just, lose the rest of them and go do something else and see what works out.
Yeah.
I want to go back to that statement that you just made because it's so powerful, especially for our audience who's listening, because in sport, we always talk about the most dangerous team or the most dangerous person is
somebody with nothing to lose. Yeah.
And it is so powerful to think about that. And if all of our mindsets were able to be shifted towards that, and we didn't value our homes so much, or we didn't value our things so much, and we literally approach things as literally having nothing to lose, but showing up every day, knowing that we were going to win, how freeing is that? You literally used that word, which was freedom or freeing. And it literally, when you said it, it hit a nerve in me and it was like, you're so right. And so I'm curious to your thoughts on, and even your process of like, I know you said it just kind of came natural to you, but as you've continued down this road and have ultimately built more things together, how have you kept with that freeing space and knowing that I really do have nothing to lose?
I don't think that I have. I think that that's something I had to do when I was young because I can't do it now. And I think a lot of people, once you have kids, everything is different. You can't take the same kinds of risks that you would have taken, or you just don't feel like you're in the same place. And, a book that I read that I reference often, it's a book called Stumbling on Happiness by Daniel Gilbert. It's like a bestseller. And the author is a scientist who says in the introduction, he says, this is a bunch of research about happiness. It's not going to make you happy. This isn't a how-to book. You'll probably hate it. He just says that in the introduction. Here's the truth, take it or leave it. And one of the things that I thought was so fascinating about that book is that he says that, everyone wants to think that they are more unique than they are, but people actually fall into their age group buckets pretty well. So even if you're someone like me, I started a company when I was 19 years old. I think I'm so special. I'm not. I want to do different things at 20 than at 40. And I think about it so often, when I was, maybe in my late 20s in New York, I was thinking, these people who have kids and move out of the city, they gave up, they're out in the suburbs, they gave up, and now I'm like, yeah, I totally get that. This is exhausting, So people fall into their age group buckets pretty well. And I remember being a kind of an energetic, late 20s kind of person. I was doing, was working out, lifting weights, and I just couldn't understand why anyone would want to do yoga. I'm like, this is so slow and so boring. I have no interest in this. I don't want to be peaceful. I didn't move here to be peaceful. And now, I would say, I think I'm going to do that in my 50s. And I think I'm on track. I'm 43. And I think when I hit 50, I'm going to start doing yoga. Like I feel it coming on, So, we're on a march towards death. There's that. But, there are many phases of life that I think you can't deny it. So yeah. I feel like I am benefiting greatly from things that were set up by my younger self who was able to do that stuff. My younger self who was able to get in a beat up car with a cat and $400 and no place to live and move to Manhattan. So that's not something that I would do today, but it's all part of the same journey.
You're talking to us about a lot of shifts in where you were in your 20s to who you are today. And, like you said, you change with your age range. I'm curious though, because there are some things that are ingrained in us that last a lifetime. What would you say that thing or those couple things are for you that has allowed you to be where you're at, to have the success that you have and be the person who you are today?
Sure. I think something that's always been a constant, just something that is fundamental to what you get here, and you might not like this one, but I've always been a really negative person. And I don't apologize for that. I don't take that back. I think that you have to be negative about things that are bad in order to change them. You know, some things are bad. Like, you should be negative about anti-vaxxers. Like, I'm a very negative person about a lot of things. But I'm also a negative person about things that could be better. I'm a negative person about people taking Bull that they shouldn't have to take. And a lot of the articles that I wrote and that brought me a following were very angry articles. I'm like, you should not take this from anyone. You should not take this from a boss. You should not take this from a boyfriend. I mean, you shouldn't take it from a girlfriend either, but it's usually a boyfriend. You shouldn't take this kind of Bull from, you know, your abusive family. Like, you should cut them off. You shouldn't take this. And so, you know, I have always had I develop ideas by criticizing. I was a philosophy major. I mean, it's just like arguing in a really, it's criticizing things in an extremely organized way. You know, that was my experience of getting a philosophy degree. It's like, I hate this, and here are 57 reasons why under 3 subheadings. And so, you know, I've always been a negative person, and I've spent a lot of time sort of making fun of empty positivity, you know, positive thinking that serves no purpose and just glosses over things that need to be recognized and analyzed and fixed. So that's something that can't change.
It's so true. There's so often whenever you're talking about to a marketer, you're talking to anybody about how to like make a point, you have to take a stand on something. You have to pick a side, and you have to have an opinion. Otherwise you just blend in like everybody else. And it's a part of what we say here at Own It is truly owning your different. Like, what is it about you that's different? What is it that about you that makes you different, that makes you stand out? And own that, lean into that, because it's going to ultimately take you further down that road that, if you have the clarity of where you're trying to go, will help propel you to that space.
And I actually want to pick up on what you just said, is the idea of clarity. When for you did you have clarity on what your passion was and what it was you ultimately wanted to do with your life?
Oh, I don't have that. Who has that? I don't have that. You know, I've written a lot about the MVP methodology. And one of the most popular articles I ever wrote was about how MVP methodology is often talked about solely in terms of developing software. And I said, I don't think this is just for developing software. I think this is for any business idea that you might have. You know, it could be like you want to start babysitting in your neighborhood. I think that MVP methodology could apply to that. What is the minimum viable product that would work here? How can you develop it with a minimum of time and money and then get feedback and then iterate on that to give people what they really want? So in a way, you know, I am saying, maybe this is the opposite of owning it, and I apologize for that, but you know, there's also serving your customer and giving people what they actually want and need rather than what you think they should want or need. And so I think that, while I've done a lot of things, you know, but I think it always comes back to, I want to give people what they actually need and want, and not just be putting out like the gen show that I think people should just, you know, should just listen to because I say so. So, you know, when people really resonated with my articles, a lot of those articles were these kind of long, you know, really long for the internet, you know, like a lot of blog posts these days, they get shorter and shorter. You know, I was writing these very long, you know, kind of sometimes ranty articles, and people really responded to them. And I would think I was attracting people who wanted to read more, and they wanted a little anger. They wanted, a little bit of rantiness in with their advice, and, maybe a few negative personalities in there as well. So it's kind of bringing these people to me and saying, what should I provide that, you know, people actually need and want? So the next step for Bullish, you know, when I was writing those articles, this is really before social media was a thing, you know, like in 2012, it's like, what was social media in 2012? You know,
right, so it was all about blogs.
Yeah. When people liked my articles, they had to just send me an email about it. Like, you couldn't retweet it. You just had to like email them and say, this was great. I enjoyed the article. And I would say, thank you. And I would say, should I have an email list or something? Should I do something about this? It was a different time. And so at the time I said, well, what is the next logical step here? How can I, you know, serve the needs of people who want this kind of conversation? And so the first thing I did actually was to start a conference, which the first one took place in Miami in 2013. And I ran that conference up through the pandemic, actually. So our 2020 conference was, our April 2020 conference was obviously canceled. And I don't know when we'll be able to have another one. But so I parlayed the blog into a conference. In 2016, Bullish became an online community. So that exists today. That is called the Bullish Society. And that is a monthly membership where we have online co-working. We have a regular, we have an accountability coach who works in there to keep our members accountable to the goals that they set. And then I post exclusive content in there as well. And so that's been, you know, going strong. And somewhere in all of that, Bullish also became an online store, which was originally, I started a little like a retail shop. It had like tote bags with our logo on them, you know, just a few things like that. And it turns out I'm just good at running an e-commerce store. And so I'm sitting in, this is actually my office corner of our warehouse. And so we actually sell over 5,000 products at this time. And so the e-commerce piece is a pretty big piece of it.
That's so amazing.
Thank you. So my idea here has always been, you know, I really want to try a lot of things and see what people respond to and what they actually want. You know, like it can be tempting in business sometimes to get so stuck on your own idea that you develop something and then it doesn't quite work. So you just, I don't know, throw more advertising money after it, you know, just trying to force it to work and, you know, try to make it easy. Like, you know, I'll give an example. I knew somebody who had this education startup and it wasn't going the way she wanted. And she said she was talking to parents. They were sending in, filling out her online form. And she said, all they want is swimming lessons for their kids and wine hours. And I was like, oh my God, that's the best business idea I have ever heard. You're going to give the kids swimming lessons and the parents can drink wine. This is, come on, they gave it to you. It's a free idea. Take it. But she was just angry about it. Like they didn't want what she wanted to give them. But right. They told her what they did want. And I love that.
It's, you know, I love how service oriented you are. And, you know, you made a comment saying, you know, I think this may not be owning it. This may not be ownership. At the end of the day, you're not owning your own business idea or coming from a really strong place of clarity. But actually what I'm hearing you say is you have extreme clarity and it's all about serving others. It's all about being able to show up and listen to what your clients are looking for, what their needs are, and tailoring your business to that. And, you know, Justin and I talk about ownership on the show every week. And for us, that is a massive definition of being able to live in ownership is it always comes from that service perspective of how can I serve others around me ahead of what my own idea or what my own ego is pushing for.
I think our theme might be owning the relationship, you know?
So yeah, for like our favorite question that our listeners love to hear, we did ask you in the pre-show, we gave her a little bit of time to prep, but what would you say is your definition of ownership?
I guess here we are. This is the big question. You know, when you asked me to do this podcast, I was like, well, this is your podcast idea. I don't know what that means. You know, like, so I guess we've come to it. We've worked through it together. So owning a relationship, owning your responsibility for that relationship, you know, that means listening to customers, listening to what they want. You know, it means solving the actual problems that they have. You know, it means not just badgering them with the message that you think that they should hear, but, you know, meeting them where they are. And so that's something, you know, as a teacher, you know, something I have always tried to do. I'm a really good math teacher, you know, but you gotta find where people are. You gotta go to exactly where they are. So owning that relationship, you know, means that if something doesn't work out, like someone doesn't buy from you or someone doesn't want to be in your community, you know, it's, you know, you have a responsibility for that. You know, did you not get the information? Is it just not a match? Are you not meeting people where they are with what they need? So I think that it all comes down to that. You know, I don't really care. I've been through so many business iterations where I'll have someone who's doing some work for me and, you know, they want to make me a logo or a website or send out an email and they want to know my kind of personal opinion about it. And I always say, I don't care. You know, like, this doesn't need to be my favorite color. You know, like my aesthetic sensibilities are not relevant here. You know, I'm not like planning a wedding where everyone has to, you know, like see what my favorite colors are. You know, my taste is not relevant here. You know, my idea here is I want to make people feel welcome. You know, I want to draw them in. I want to make sure people don't feel embarrassed trying to get help. And, you know, just really, really owning that relationship.
I love it. Jen, where can people find you and ultimately the Bullish Society if they're interested in learning more?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find everything at getbullish.com. So GETBULLISH, getbullish.com. And from there, you can link to the blog, obviously, the online store, and the membership community called the Bullish Society.
I love it. And I'm sure Jen now has a email list fully going that you can join as well once you get to that website redirected. It's no longer 2012.
It's no longer 2012.
I love it. I love it. So guys, as you go forward, it's so often that we get distracted by our own needs, our own wants, our own ideas. And rather what truly allows us to get certain clarities is when our consumers and our customers ultimately give us the answers, when they truly literally guide us down that road. And by being able to listen to those nudges, by being able to listen to your consumer, meet them where they are, you can ultimately own that relationship. And when you own that relationship, it provides massive clarity and massive eye-opening moments that help you be in the position to have nothing to lose. And that is a very dangerous and very upper hand position to be in, and one that most entrepreneurs are looking for and trying to figure out where that is. And as we continue down that road, it allows us to understand again that success is different. We have to act differently. And when we do that, we can truly own it. We'll see you guys next week.